First off, I'd like to say thank you to Mary Beth and to Locust Grove for this invitation. I always like to come out and talk about our quilt collection. I'd also like to thank Locust Grove for giving me a new experience on the way up here. I've seen a lot of things along I-65, but I've never passed a goat at 70 miles an hour. But you never know. I once saw a guy in a gorilla suit on my way to Berea, so you just don't know. Let me see if I can remember how to turn on this. Okay. Let's try it. See if it'll advance. All right. I promise I'm not going to read this whole script. I've just got a few things that I'll periodically refer to, and then I generally tend to go off script. Historic textiles reflect the world of their makers. While the faces in this program represent 18th, 19th, and 20th century political, religious, and literary figures, the places or built environment of public consist of public and private structures, both real and imagined. Additionally, some of them convey family, community, and/or church associations. These depictions are accomplished through traditional quilt making and weaving techniques, decorative stitches, and the creative use of printed and novelty materials. Now, the textiles I've selected today are primarily Kentucky made. A few simply exist in Kentucky Museum collections or in collections of institutions from the surrounding states. All right, now this is the oldest textile in the program today, and this is out of the collection of the Kentucky Historical Society in Frankfort, and I'll take it anytime they get bored with it. Historical figures have long influenced the design of quilts and other textiles. This particular textile now is a quilt, but this originally was four fabric panels that apparently were curtains in the home of Thomas Davis Carneal in Frankfort. Now, we tend to think going to yard sales and whatever is a new thing. It's not. Sarah Runyon Anderson actually purchased these curtains at his estate sale after his death, and she decided to make a quilt out of them. And the family tradition is that she wove the linen lining that is used to back this quilt and supposedly used flax grown on her father's farm in New Jersey. Now, accept that or not, it seems a long way to go for flax from my point of view, but it's a good story, and frankly, most of what we know about a lot of quilts and textiles are stories, aren't they? We can't prove them. Now, this yard goods panel features General Zachary Taylor. He was a Virginia native who moved to Louisville as a child, and he became a hero of the war with Mexico, which occurred between 1846 and 1848. Now, his nickname was Old Rough and Ready, and this particular textile panel, that's American-made, and it's said to represent him at the Battle of Palo Alto. Supposedly, that is his favorite mount, Whitey. Doesn't look white to me, but again, who knows? And apparently, he is shown directing his troops. And supposedly, he said to keep a bright lookout for them, men. Keep a bright lookout for them. Now, there are several other textiles that were done celebrating, commemorating Zachary Taylor. And eventually, of course, he did become our 12th president. And of course, he has local ties. And this is not Kentucky made, but it is in the Kentucky Museum collection. Now, here is one of my favorite quilts. And this, again, it's another political textile. This is the Henry Clay presentation quilt. It was made approximately about 1850 and is attributed to Lucretia Mott Clay, who is Henry Clay's wife. And the reason it is called the Henry Clay quilt is this fabulous needlework portrait that you see in the center of the quilt. Now, isn't that just kind of a stunner? It means most of us needle workers need to step up our game, I think. We believe it's based on that portrait of Henry Clay by Joseph Nagel, who is a Philadelphia artist. That particular painting is in the collection of the National Portrait Gallery. But remember, at this time, they were doing lots of engravings of portraits, and they would appear in newspapers and magazines and things. So probably, Mrs. Clay saw this particular engraving and decided to include a needlework representation of her husband. Now, this is not political, but I'll show it to you now. Look at these wonderful pastoral scenes of children and wildlife. Again, this is a way that people can be depicted in 19th century quilts. Now, obviously, this is on the high end. These are very romanticized, but they're absolutely stunning. And I will mention that this quilt was purchased through the assistance of the Kentucky Heritage Quilt Society, which is a wonderful statewide organization. If you're interested, yes, ma'am.
Are these scenes printed on the fabric?
No, that's needlework. That is cruel. It's cruel embroidery. It's cruel embroidery. So it is pretty stunning. All right, here is a Henry Clay quilt that, frankly, I hadn't heard of until I got on the internet to work on this program. And I saw this, and I said, I've got to include it. This quilt was made by, and I'm going to go to some, let's see. Okay, it was made by Ellen Anderson of Louisville. And here you're seeing a Courier Journal article from 1942, I believe. Henry Clay was sometimes called the Star of the West. He's probably our most important political figure to come out of Kentucky. He was a star in his day, and he's remembered as a star now. He ran three times for the presidency as a Whig candidate, and he's known as the Great Compromiser. But reportedly, the family story is that his niece made this quilt, finished it after his death. Now, time has not been kind to it. Here are remnants of the quilt that were photographed by the Kentucky Quilt Project, which was one of the early and leading quilt documentation projects in the United States. And many of the quilts you're going to see today were documented by the Quilt Project. One of the things that's nice, if you look in the upper right corner, you see that eagle. That has a banner in its beak, and basically, let's see if I get it right, his country's friend in the hour of danger. That was from a silk political ribbon, and that was a motto that he used in his 1844 campaign. This particular quilt was mentioned in 1853 in an article in the New York Herald Post because the maker had apparently entered it in what was the equivalent of a World's Fair there. So it was a national attention getter, but as I said, unfortunately, time has not been kind. Okay, here is the last quilt that has a tie to Henry Clay. It's a little bit, not really, really strong, but it is there. This was done by Virginia Mason Ivy, and it's in the collection of the Speed Museum, and she is one of the preeminent quilt makers in Kentucky history. This quilt is fabulous. We borrowed it at my institution back in about 91. And basically, if you look here, it doesn't show up real well in the slide, but that is a figure of Henry Clay, a statue. And the Speed's curator's theory is, and I think it makes sense, I've seen pictures of the statue. That's probably a copy of a statue by Joel Hart. So again, Clay was an important figure, and people included politics. Politics were on the brain back in the 19th century. Very important. All right, this is one of the few coverlets you're going to see today, but I included it because of its political association. This particular coverlet is in a style called jacquard, and this is not something that your great-great-great-grandmother would have woven at home. This was done on a jacquard loom and by a professional weaver. And if you look in the corners, you'll see the representations of George Washington. Now, George Washington was probably our first American icon because he was the father of our country. You know, he couldn't lie about chopping down that cherry tree, all kinds of things. I believe that this particular coverlet probably was done about the time of the centennial because of the subject matter. And we were interested in our past, but I believe my current theory is that the George Washington motif is a copy of that statue which was erected in New York City in 1853. And it looks quite similar. Now, here is another quilt that incorporates George Washington into it. This is the Eugenia Garnett Murray Crazy Quilt. It was made in Barron County, down towards Bowling Green. And one of the things that she did was, is she incorporated that silk ribbon from the Philadelphia Centennial Exposition. So again, this was done at the height of the crazy quilt period. You have all that elaborate and interesting materials and embroidery stitches. But again, George Washington is an iconic motif in our history. Family tradition holds that she entered this in the Columbian Exposition of 1893, where it won a blue ribbon, but I have not been able to document that. But I have to confess, I haven't really done a lot of looking, but that is the tradition. All right, here is the last political, I believe it's the last, no, it's the next to last political quilt I'm going to show you. Even in the 20th century, politics and presidents have a pull on quilt makers. This is the president's quilt. It was made by Irene Poston from Fairdale. And it, again, was one of the finds of the Kentucky Quilt Project. And I can't stress how important it is if you have historic quilts in your personal collection. Think about the next time there is a quilt documentation project. Think about getting them registered so we can continue to have knowledge of what was produced here in Kentucky. It's oh so important. I believe that was done with some kind of crayon and then heat set, is I believe what I noticed when I read the Quilt Project documentation. All right, this is my last political quilt, and I included it just because I think it's whimsical and fun. This is the William H. Natcher necktie quilt. And William H. Natcher represented the 2nd Congressional District, which is my district, for, I believe it was 41 years. Now, there are a couple of things he's really important for. Think about politics in this day. He never took a campaign contribution. He never spent more than $5,000. And he did 18,000-plus consecutive roll call votes. There is one story on him that he told. We can't document it, but he talked about it to demonstrate his dedication. I think it almost became a curse in a sense. Once you make so many roll call votes, you never want to leave. You know, you can't miss. He was up here in Louisville, and he was supposed to get on a plane flight back to D.C. The flights were grounded because of snow. So he hired a taxi driver to drive him to D.C. So no taxi driver has stepped forth to validate that story, but it's a great story. Now, another thing I like about this quilt is, did anybody ever meet Congressman Natcher or maybe see him at a political appearance? Well, imagine, I mean, when I didn't really meet him, but he occasionally came to Western for programs. He was a very tall man, very erect. He was in his 80s, but he was ramrod straight, impeccably dressed, very old school. But he had something that he was very fond of. Now, he was a good Baptist, so you can't really bet if you're a good Baptist. But he would bet neckties on the results of certain votes and Congressional League softball games. And so if he won the bet, the person would have to give him a necktie. And so quite often, let's see if I can, whoops, I'm sorry. You can see I'm so skilled with using this laser pointer. Well, we're not even going to try. Look at the ice cream cone. That alone is worth the price of admission, I think. Okay. Now, here's a literary figure. This is Robert Penn Warren, and of course, he was born in Guthrie, Kentucky, and he was one of the giants of American literature and poetry of the 20th century. He won 3 Pulitzer Prizes, one for his novel, All the King's Men, and 2 for poetry. Now, this is a very interesting project to me because this was done by school children at Marion High School, Marion County High School. And basically, they pulled together things that represented things associated with his life, quotations, book titles, etc. And they incorporated into this quilt that they made as a high school class project, which I think is fun and it's innovative. So you get a sense of him as a person, but you also get a sense of place. Now, if you're interested in Warren, his birthplace, they do have his birthplace home, is still there in Guthrie, and you can go see that. But we also have a Robert Penn Warren Study Center, and the Robert Penn Warren Library is at WKU. So that's ultimately how we got the quilt. Now, here we're moving into the area of religion. And again, another very important figure in Kentucky's history is Father Thomas Merton, who was a Trappist monk. And apparently at one point, Penny Sisto, how many of you have seen quilts by Penny Sisto? All right, many of you. I believe she still lives in Floyd Knobs, is that the case? Okay, so she is from this area, but she used to live in next to the Abbey at Gethsemane. And so she would see Merton passing by her from time to time. Now, of course, he's a monk. He has a vow of silence. He never talks to her. But I think this quilt is very indicative of her art. Just look at the facial expression. It's so evocative. Now, what she said about this quilt is, this is based on his book, The Seven-Story Mountain. And what she told me about this when we purchased the quilt is that she had started this wall hanging on the anniversary of Merton's death. Basically, the monks in the bottom panel are depicted, and I quote, "with their choir hoods pulled up, these monks live lives akin to the toughest mountain climbers." Now, she was also quite deliberate in her fabric choices. The velvet. That's to honor the monks. Kings amongst men. Purple for mourning. And it doesn't show up in this slide, but that black around the border, that's actually a very rich, rich purple. Purple for royalty. All right. Now we're getting to the quilt, which is why I got the invitation today. This is the colonial history quilt. Many of you are aware that there was a big resurgence of interest in quilt making in the early 20th century here in the United States. And one of the leaders of that was Ruby Short McKim. And you see a photograph of her as a young woman. And McKim did a couple of things. She designed quilt patterns. She had a business where she would sell these patterns and things. And one of the geniuses of some of these early quilt makers, they were able to sell newspapers on syndicating their patterns. So like once a week, they would run a single block, and that was encouragement for subscriptions, wasn't it? Because once you collected 2 or 3 blocks, you would be hooked. You would want to come back. Now the story on this, and it's basically a lap size quilt. This actually, the original pattern has 24 blocks, but we only have 16 here, so who knew what happened? But back in the early 90s, a friend of Dolores Bensing, who is from Jefferson County, she is deceased now, I don't know if any of you know Dolores, but she was a lovely, lovely individual. She found the blocks and some newspaper clippings at a yard sale here in the area. So she bought them, gave them to Dolores, who was a quilt maker, and she ended up doing this quilt, and she gave it a patriotic set. And the reason she did that was because it's the colonial history quilt. So you'll see people like Balboa, William Penn signing his treaty. There's an early mission, an early log cabin, Washington at Valley Forge, all kinds of historical figures associated with our early history. Now, I want you to be really open to this and tell me if you think this particular block looks anything like George Rogers Clark. I think they call this poetic license. All right, and one more comment on this quilt. One of the most popular images that you see repeated in various forms through like the 1920s, the 1930s, those early decades, is the lady at the spinning wheel. That is an iconic image associated with the colonial revival and the colonial quilt revival. It was so popular. It's based on a poem by Longfellow, The Courtship of Miles Standish. And this is Priscilla Mullins. And, of course, she's the woman and she's at her spinning wheel. So it kind of tells you about the ideas of, you know, job responsibilities. But she's there spinning for her man. But they actually started a women's magazine and gave it the name Modern Priscilla. That's how popular that Priscilla image was. Now here's a quilt with Jefferson County and Louisville connections. And this is a quilt I feel very close to. This is the Godey quilt, and it was made by Mildred Potter LeSueur, who is a Bowling Green native. But she ended up spending most of her life up here in Louisville. And she decided one day, supposedly after seeing a quilt her mother made, which is gorgeous, she said, I can do better than that. Now, she's a woman who supposedly never made a quilt before in her life. She was a good sewer. She was an excellent sewer. But she'd never made a quilt. So she decided to make the Godey quilt. And it's named because of its resemblance, inspired by the Godey's Ladies book. But what she did was, is she used a lot of printed images as inspiration. This is a graphic out of Needlecraft magazine that's the partial basis for this one. Here's an ad out of the Louisville Courier Journal in December 19, 1933. Now, if you look at her quilt blocks, she's usually using several different design inspirations. So she's pulling things and making changes. And then here's the last one. Vogue magazine ran a series of articles on the history of 19th century fashion. And she saved all this stuff. That's the amazing thing. She saved her materials. She saved her letters. And that is pretty much a straight steal on that particular applique block. Now, here is something I came across about 6 months ago, and I got really, really excited. And I think I found this even before this program invitation. This is a quilt. This gentleman, John Friedman Jr., apparently he was an Owensboro native, and he ended up going to Hollywood at some point when he was a young man, and he worked on the team that did the Gone with the Wind movie. He was a production and design assistant, and I can't remember if this is from 1939. I believe it is. Yeah, it is from 1939. They did an interview with him, the Courier Journal did, and apparently he started kind of noodling around, and he decided to basically design a quilt in miniature. And he sent it home, the pattern, to his mother, and she liked it. And she said, you know, develop that to full scale, and I'm going to make that quilt. So he did that, And he supposedly even sent her fabric swatches, you know, the leftovers from his costume designs that he was working. He talks about in this article, you can get it online, that dress here that Vivian Lee is wearing, he talked about making copies of that dress because it's a long shoot, and she apparently, supposedly, wore this dress throughout the production, and it gets rattier and rattier as her economic situation declines. So he talks about that was one of his jobs. He had to age the clothing, the costumes that some of these actresses and actors were wearing. Now here's one last Colonial Revival quilt. This is the Colonial Lady pattern. And again, this is fictitious, but it, when you look at this, it tells you how people viewed our past. During the Colonial Revival, people looked back to the past, our so-called colonial past, because I think, you know, what was going on in 1940? We were getting shortly into war. What had we just come out of? We were in the Depression. Times were not good, so there's comfort in the past. Now, there's nothing really accurate about that. But they didn't let that slow them down. Okay, another way quilts document people and family is through these friendship quilts. It's a way to document your family, your community, your group. Now, this is the Palmore family quilt, and this is a family who Judge Palmore, who used to be on the Supreme Court, it's associated with his family, but it was made in Monroe County, and it's an album-style quilt, but it does use many of the stitches that you see in Crazy Quilts. So there is some overlap, if you want to view it that way, but there are 70 family members' names on this particular quilt. I think if you were doing genealogy on that family, a quilt like this would be worth looking at because you get a lot of names. Now, here's another friendship quilt. This was made in Greene County. And again, you have family members, but again, you also have the sentiments that you commonly see on friendship and crazy quilts of that time. You know, what is a home without father? Remember me when I am gone. Another quilt we have has a sentiment, Aunt Tina is gone. Quilts are a way that you keep people as part of yourself. This is an album friendship. They would do these as a show of support. This was done for a little boy. He was about, I think he was 8 maybe when this was done for him. And his mother had died when he was very young, and so he was raised by an aunt. This is the Owens family quilt. And again, it's a way to look at it and think of people. This was done by a woman who lived near London, Kentucky. And we don't know a lot about her family, but we do know that she was a midwife and the family ran a general store. But again, she's capturing her family in this quilt. And how many people do genealogy? Really, I'd have thought more in this group. Anyway, this literally is a family tree, isn't it? It was done by a woman up at Carrollton. I borrowed this quilt in, I think, 1995 for an exhibit. And she told me that she started this quilt around the time of her wedding anniversary and 50th or something in 1981. And by the time 1995 rolled around, she'd added a whole bunch more leaves. I also like it because everybody's part of the family. If you look at the bottom of that family tree, you'll see Tiger, the family dog. Now, sometimes you have school associations. When you think about it, the school is often the glue that holds a small town together, isn't it? Well, this was done by the Old Union School students in Butler County in 1942, and that school's no longer there anymore. So this is a representation of those people, of that past. Now, this quilt was done right here in Louisville. It's the St. Charles Catholic Church. And it's a friendship, sort of a friendship quilt. It supposedly was done as a gift for the founding pastor, Father C.P. Raffo. Now, it's my understanding this quilt is in the collection of the Shelburne Museum in Shelburne, Vermont. What's nice about it is, again, you have all of these people associated with that particular church. The style, they call that sometimes red work, and red work was really popular in household linens and textiles at this particular time. Now, here's another example. Quite often when ministers leave, historically, the ladies' aid group from the church might make him a friendship quilt as a going-away gift. Again, it's a way that when you leave, you take your community with you. You remain a part of them. And this, according to the inscription, was presented to Reverend D.F. Kerr by the Sisters of Mount Hebron and other churches. Now, he was sort of an itinerant minister. He moved around a lot, but he ultimately ended up in Bowling Green, which is how the Kentucky Museum got this quilt. All right, here's another fabulous fundraising. Fundraising quilts are quite often a way that groups raise money. This one is pretty extraordinary and is more atypical. This was done to raise money for the Louisville Baptist Orphans Home. Today we know it as the Kentucky Homes for Children. I think I've got that right. But basically, individual blocks, you could buy the right to contribute an individual block, and the records with the organization is I think it costs like $18 a block, which was a huge amount of money in that time. But look at all the elaborate embroidery work and the different types of crazy quilt stitches and motifs. Now, this is the more classic example of fundraising quilt that we think of today that we recognize. This was done in 1930, and it was done to raise money by the Ladies' Aid Society of the Broadhead Christian Church in Rockcastle County. It's a quilt top. It supposedly costs 10 cents per name. Now, if you think about it, there's 593 names on this. That was $59. In 1930, in the midst of the Depression, that was huge. That was a tremendous amount of money. Now, quite often, you might also raffle off the quilt, the finished quilt, and that would raise more money. I actually threw the next two slides in this morning. I decided I had to put Izetta in here. This is the Desert Storm Desert Shield quilt done by Izetta Steele, who used to live at Fort Thomas. And this is, again, it's an example of people and place. In 1990, her son was a surgeon, and he was assigned to an evac hospital in the Persian Gulf region. Well, you can imagine, any of you who were parents who've had children in the military in conflict zones, how incredibly difficult that is. Well, she basically started making this wall hanging as a way to deal with her anxiety. And so you've got her son, you've got the soldiers. Remember the yellow ribbons that were a show of support? Flags of all the various countries in the coalition. So again, this really has a wonderful sense of place, of belonging. Probably most of you have seen representations of this quilt. This is probably the most important and most well-known quilt to come out of Kentucky. It's the graveyard quilt. It's in the collection of the Historical Society in Frankfurt. And yes, again, I go over there in the middle of the night to pick this up if they wanted to transfer it. It's highly suggestive of Victorian mourning customs. You see you've got the fence, you've got the interior graveyard, you've got the coffins, you've got the weeping flowers. It just screams Victorian mourning customs. It's a truly a brilliant, brilliant quilt. Now, mourning remains an issue even today, and it's a way quilt making can help people deal with their grief. This is an example of two panels that were made by a project over in Owensboro that was organized by the Archdiocese of Owensboro in around 1993-94. It's hard to think about it now, but if we think back, remember what it was like early on in the AIDS epidemic and how there was a lot of no information, misinformation, a lot of people didn't know how to deal with it. And so for these people who had lost loved ones, they had no way to share their grief. It was very difficult. So going to the pastoral center every week to work on these AIDS panels was something that they could do. And these are basically done in the style of that NAMES National AIDS Memorial Quilt Project. And I looked online the other day, and right now there are 48,000 of these panels that have been registered with that project. So it's pretty incredible. But again, it's a way of keeping that person as part of you, saying goodbye to him or her, recognizing them. Okay, I talk about place and events. Quilts can be suggestive of that. This, again, this is Virginia Mason Ivy, and she's the woman that made that elaborate figural and floral quilt earlier. This isn't a quilt that's done on the Russellville Fair. And how we know that is she kindly put an inscription on her quilt. She did a quilted inscription that tells us that. We can see the center fairgrounds. We can see the tent. We can see the animals, we can see people. It's absolutely a fabulous, wonderful landmark, incredible quilt. And it's in the collection of the Smithsonian Institution in D.C. Now, getting back to religion, sometimes people express their faith and their belief in figural quilts that have to do with religion. This particular one was done in Bowling Green. I have two by this woman in this slide program. And these are Artex textile paints that she's done. And I want to make sure that I get her quote correct here. Okay. She had an interesting life. She's been interviewed. She was interviewed by students in Western's Folk Study program. But anyway, she was secretary treasurer of her church. She had been a bootlegger previously, and her husband was the county jailer. So she had an interesting life, I think. But anyway, this is what she told a Western Folk Studies student in 83. This is what inspired her to make her first Bible quilt. My husband and I were studying the Bible one year. Then, and we were studying about Moses, you know? And what a life he'd had. I took me a piece of material and I drawed like I thought Moses would be. And then I said, I'm going to make me a quilt. That was the first one that I'd done then, you see. And so I made that one and then I began to pick up on the other things in the Bible. So this is not her first quilt, but it's one of her Bible quilts. And then here's another one of her Bible quilts. So, you know, and they're so much fun because they're from the 70s, and the material would give most regular quilt makers horrors because it's, you know, this, anyway, it's, but they're fabulous, and they speak of the time. They speak of the time, and the subject matter is so interesting. Okay, talking about people and events. Violence, sadly, is nothing new in American society. And here we have two quilts that were made approximately in the same time period. The one on the left, and I apologize, all I have is a newspaper photo, is this was done by students at DuPont Manual High School right here in Louisville. And basically, they had all been victims of some form of domestic violence. I assume the quilt is still at the school. I didn't have an opportunity to check on that, but you only see part of the quilt. There's basically, I think, probably one to two more rows of quilt blocks. And then on the right, you see a quilt that was done by the Battered Offenders Self-Help Group from the Women's Correctional Facility for Women in Oldham County, which is also very close to here. And unfortunately, the photograph quality is such I couldn't get you a detail shot. But again, people are exploring the impacts of violence on their lives. So this is a way for these women to talk about themselves and what they've been through. All right, let's get to happier times. Quite often, quilt makers look to literature and magazines for illustrations and inspiration, and such was the Kate Greenaway figures. Now, she published her first book in 1879. She was English, and they're charming, aren't they? I mean, just charming, charming. She was everywhere, her figures. And they were often readily adapted for quilts. Now, I ended up just choosing two figures off of Kentucky Museum quilts, and admittedly, they're not the finest details, but they give you an idea of the types of motifs that were available. And you could buy pattern stencils, for example. Now, here is more sophisticated use of the Greenaway figures. This is the Mount Carmel Church fan quilt. It's in the collection of the Smithsonian American Art Museum. But if you look in the upper right corner, you'll see, again, Greenaway figures. Now, down in the lower right, that is a figure off of the Louisville Baptist Orphans Home quilt. And so that's very typically Kate Greenaway. If you want to know more about the Mount Carmel Church, there's information about it online at the Smithsonian, but also the Triplett Sisters have a blog, and if you're interested in quilt making, check it out. They're wonderful. They're collectors, and they write extensively. Okay, and then here's another use of sort of those romanticized images of children. They were very popular during the Victorian image era, these romanticized notions of childhood. And this is off of that Murray quilt. And that's like a padded greeting card. All right, quilt makers and quilts are not static. They advance with the times and the technology. And here you see basically things being printed on silk and incorporated as scraps into this particular crazy quilt. Now we get to the 20th century and we see digital technology for photographs, and quilt makers soon figured out they could put photographs on their quilts. This was done by a lady from Lawrenceburg, and she literally turned her family photograph album into a quilt. Anybody remember the Holly hobby craze of the 1970s? Well, it ain't new, folks. These are the Sunbonnet Babies, and this particular book is the first time they appeared, and that's in 1902, and it gives you that sunbonnet image of that little girl. Now, this is the Keepsake quilt, which was a quilt that appeared in 1915 in this book by Marie Webster, and she, again, was one of these leading figures in the colonial quilt revival. She published the first book on quilt making. And so anyway, this is the sort of the high style, what she's recommending. And you could buy the pattern for this. This is a version that was done right here in Kentucky by a woman from Lexington. And you can see she basically gets the sunbonneted figures correct. But for whatever reason, she decided not to put in the picket fence or this rather elaborate border. But again, you get the basic idea. Now, this is what we generally tend to think of today when we think of sunbonnet Sue. Now, sometimes you'll see these referred to as Dutch girl or Dutch boy, and that happens more in the South where those terms are used. These are a little more later versions, a little more contemporary. The quilt on the left, that was done by a woman for her great nieces, I believe, and she was 70 at the time. And she did two versions of this. And then the quilt on the right is interesting. That was done by an African-American quilt maker from Bardstown, and she was a teacher, an educator, and her husband actually was the first African-American to serve on the school board in that town. So they're an important family. Now, this is a little crib quilt out of the Kentucky Museum collection, and again, nursery rhyme quilts offered an opportunity to put children front and center in quilt making. This particular design was done by someone named Ann Orr, who was a needlework editor for one of the ladies' magazines. I want to say Good Housekeeping, but I'm not sure that's correct. But she also sold patterns and things. Now, this is a modern representation of school children, and this was done by Terry Hancock Mangot. I apologize if I'm mangling her name. But again, she has Kentucky roots. She was from Cold Springs. And she is a leading, or at least several years ago, was a leading modern art quilter in the United States. Probably about 10 years ago, there was a poll of the 100 most important quilts. And it wasn't this one, but it was another one of her quilts that actually made that list. So she's a quite important quilter. And she said, when I quizzed her about this quilt, she said that her quilts generally reflect what is going on in her life. And her oldest child was just starting off to go to school when she did this. So again, you have the sense of people and the sense of place going on here. We could do a whole talk on Rebecca Seigel. She is just so wonderful. This is out of a set of three quilts, and she's looking at railroad travel in the 1940s. And these are in the collection of the Historical Society. But she does wonderful quilts that incorporate people in them, and sometimes they're fictional, and sometimes they're real people. And then contemporary quilt makers tend to be more increasingly interested in cultural diversity of our world and in using new and innovative modern fabrics. Now, quilts do provide a sense of place. Textiles provide a sense of place. This is very simple, but it's still evocative. This was done as a project by students at the Bevier Cleeton School in, I think it was the 8th grade class, in 1931. Now, that school is no longer gone, but it lives on in the little wall hanging that these students did. State flower and state bird quilts have long been really, really popular, and they started showing up at the early on in the 20th century. This is one of the popular patterns. It's called the 50 State Educational Quilt. And frankly, dating this is a little interesting. I was fortunate enough to attend a workshop about 2 weeks ago in which this got talked about. And this actually is kind of a little more blue. That looks pretty black, but it's a little more blue. But, you know, originally I thought this quilt was probably done during the bicentennial because there was a revival in quilt making. And it possibly could have been done, but this pattern goes back to the 1950s, so it makes it a challenge. But the woman who made this did, her daughter said, had done 100 quilts. Another approach to state quilts, this one is a state flowers, and this was done by a company named the Rainbow Block Company. But again, there are a lot of these floating out there in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s. But again, that sense of place, identification. Now, this is a fun quilt that's closer to home. And this was done in 1990, and it's at the Historical Society. And I like it. One of the reasons I like it is the woman who made it worked at a sewing factory in Burkesville. And we forget that, you know, starting in the 30s, but the 30s into certainly probably the 80s, there were a lot of textile companies here in Kentucky, and a lot of women were sewing. And what they would frequently do would take home scraps of fabric with them at the end of the day, or they might buy the leftovers. And I don't know if this is old fabric or recycled fabric or newly purchased fabric, but again, it connects us to her work connects us to that whole industry, which is kind of dying here in Kentucky. Let's try this again. All right, now sometimes the use of buildings is actually fairly literal. And this is a log cabin print, probably from around maybe the time of the centennial. Now sometimes the idea of building a structure is very metaphorical, like in this log cabin barn raising quilt. But sometimes, again, it's very literal, representational. And this is Honeymoon Cottage, and it was popular, very popular for a couple of decades. And it appeared in Ruby Short McKim's 101 Patchwork Patterns. But here you see some variations. You see the variation on the left. They call it Log House or Honeymoon Cottage. And then on the right, you see a slightly different building. Well, here we go. All right, here is another coverlet. And Jacquard coverlets in the mid to the late 19th century, quite often you would see different types of motifs woven into them, particularly into the border. And for some reason, they liked governmental structures, probably because they represented authority. And that's what we have going on here. Now, here is the small city. And this is a really wonderful, innovative approach in modern quilt making to that whole idea of building, that whole idea of place. And then even more modern, how many people have gone on quilt barn trail drive tours? A couple of you. Well, this represents that whole thing, and the quilt maker said, let me find it. She said, home is where the quilt is, and sometimes it's on the barn. This quilt was inspired by the trails of quilt barns that wind through southern Ohio and Kentucky, my home states. The quilt trails remind us to preserve and cherish both the barns and the quilting heritage that would otherwise be fading from our landscape. I designed this quilt to capture the strong graphic appeal that these quilt barns have for me. Now, this was a fairly recent find for me. I've looked at Florence Pito's book on historic quilts any number of times, but I never noticed this plate in it. This is Male High School. And her book came out in 39, and it's really interesting because it was made by a man named E.R. Dickerson. He was an insurance salesman, and he moved to Louisville in 1899, and apparently when he retired around 1922, he got bored. Now, a male quilter is not unprecedented. There are a number of well-known male quilters during the colonial quilt revival. But he's interesting because he did at least seven quilts, because Pito cites him on that. But basically, this is why he said he started making quilts. This is what he told the Courier-Journal in an interview. All my life, I'd heard quilts, quilts, quilts from my wife and her friends. And apparently, he had had a son who had graduated from Male High School in 1910, and then his wife also had a connection to it. And so at some point, he decided to make this quilt. And he told the reporter, because this is very monochromatic, there's not a lot of color in it, it's just shades of white and gray. He said, to secure the proper shading, he dyed materials several shades of gray, because there is only one shade of gray in the Peter Pan material. So he had to work at it. Now, honestly, I don't know where this quilt is. If anybody out there has seen this quilt, I want to know about it. The same goes for that Gone with the Wind quilt. You know, these are really treasures, and they don't need to be lost to history. It'd be nice to know about them. Here we've got somebody who is literally doing a representation of the U.S. Capitol, and this is from 1894. And then this is the last quilt I'll show you today. And this is called Old Frankfort, and it was done in celebration of Frankfort's 200th birthday. And if you look really carefully, you can identify some iconic Frankfurt structures, although I confess my knowledge of Frankfurt is apparently lacking because I didn't really match most of them to my feeling. But you've got the old Capitol, there's a hemp mill, there's a courthouse, a hospital, some various structures. So in closing then, I hope I've made a case for the fact that quilts are one way that Kentuckians were able to preserve that sense of person and that sense of place in fabric, and I'll be glad to take any questions.